So what makes a quantum computation? I think this is what you say in English. Of course, frankly, I don't know. And I do not promise that you will learn anything from this talk about this question that you didn't already know. But I do think that the description of the one-way model, as I'm going to present it, will hopefully provide you with new perspectives on this question: what are the essential components of a quantum computer? It is at least a question that has occupied me for the last few years, and I think it could also be one of the themes of this conference. And in fact, I tried to give really a good introduction to this. So while I was listening to several of these very inspiring talks at this conference, I tried to sketch an introduction to this. And at some point, believe me, I thought I know the answer, but the problem is I cannot read it anymore. So I guess what I'm trying to say is this: what I'm surprised about in this field is the following thing. It seems that some of the developments one had seen in the theory of classical computation, although I'm not an expert on this, seem to be repeating themselves also in the attempt to formulate and to investigate the theory of quantum computation as the basic theory for computation, maybe also for physics, in the following sense that, now I need maybe, is there a pointer or something? Yeah, in the sense that, that, well, maybe we should first ask, you know, what makes classical computation? And as we all know, there have been various models of classical computers around, and these are now called classical models of computation, but I think that one of the few explicit models that makes explicit connection to classical physics as you would study it in a graduate course, undergraduate course, is, for example, the billiard ball model studied in the context of reversal computation by Bennett and others. But in any way, we all know that there is the Church-Turing thesis, and it has always, to me, been a miracle, frankly speaking, that these models are, in this specified sense, in this sense, is more or less equivalent. Why should they be? And I have never understood that. But I had a serious hope that in quantum computation, we might end up in a better situation. So the strange, surprising thing, I can still read that for me, is that the history seems to repeat itself in the theory of quantum computation. Why? In quantum computation, we have had now a similar situation over the last so and so many years, that we have quite different models, starting from the quantum Turing machine introduced by Deutsch and Basirani and others, and then by the quantum circuit model, then quantum adiabatic computation, and also the measurement-based quantum computation models, all seem to be equivalent in the sense that they can efficiently simulate each other. And again, you can just ask the question, why is that? I had a serious hope that in quantum mechanics, we would have a better chance to understand why, to give maybe an explanation at a certain level why this is. And this is because quantum mechanics, and in particular you are the audience, or part of you are certainly the audience, to maybe share some of these opinions, offers a tighter package, you know, about our theory of nature. And so it may be, and that's my hope, that there is much less room eventually, once we have a better foundation of quantum mechanics, maybe in some axiomatic sense, and several names have and several approaches have been discussed here, that this will somehow narrow down the different possibilities, and we will have one angle language that describes objects, that describes information, that is the language of quantum mechanics, that describes natural objects, but also that provides the scope to provide information processing. So that's what I'm going to say. I'm surprised, what I wanted to say, I'm surprised about this, and I'm hoping that maybe this is one of the conferences which will bring us a little bit further, in fact, also to the question, you know, what are the essential ingredients? Can we describe quantum computation in a nutshell. Having said that, I would now like to describe you one model of quantum computation which I've been involved with in the development, and that is the one-way quantum computer that Robert Rosendorf and I have developed starting about 2000. And the working principle of this model is very different from the circuit model, for example, in the sense that here the information processing is done only via measurements of single entangled qubits in a so-called cluster state. I'm going to describe that. We have shown that this model can simulate any quantum logic circuit efficiently. Yeah, so it's equivalent. Now, it can simulate any quantum logic circuit efficiently, but its principle of operation is quite different. And I would say that the most general way of describing it is that you exploit quantum correlations that are in a certain quantum mechanical resource for information process. I would like to mention from the beginning that there are several other works that are some in some way related to that. And I will not go through all of this. I would like to mention the teleportation scheme by Gottesman and Chuang, later works by Nielsen, De Billion, and others who showed that any circuit can be simulated by only doing measurements by 4-qubit, 3-qubit, 2-qubit measurements. And also, maybe more on the implementation side, the proposal by Knill, Laflamme, and Milburn, linear optics quantum computer, may be summarized under this. These models are, however, distinct from the model I'm going to talk about, because the view behind all of this is a different way of realizing a quantum circuit, and that's not necessarily the case here. Also, more recently, there has been lots of work on this model, on quantum measurement-based models in general, exploring the connection also by Bertrix and Yoron, the formulation of measurement-based quantum Turing machines, and of course by Kashefi and Vincent Danos and others, the measurement calculus that is developing a kind of programming languages, in a sense. Ilham is going to explain herself later today. I will not make any connection to these models because Elam has basically done, and I would like to refer you to this introduction lecture by Elham Kashefi, and I will now really concentrate on this. So in the next few two transparencies, I would just describe what is the essential ingredients of the model. It's this. First, the resources are as follows. What you need is a set of qubits, n qubits, prepared in a specific entangled state. We imagine that these qubits are spatially located on a lattice. It can be 1, 2, 3, or higher dimensional lattices if you like. It could also be some other types of lattices or graphs. But we started with this scenario. So imagine that each point in Z2 is occupied by a qubit. And all of these qubits are by some means brought into a state that is a certain stabilizer state, which we call cluster state then, i.e. it is an eigenstate of a complete set of operators of the following form. For each site A, the stabilizer operator is the product of Pauli spin flip operator applied on A and the spin phase flip operator sigma C applied to the neighbors. So that is to say, I will often use this pictorial language, if you apply this multi-qubit spin operator on the lattice at this region, you will get the state back. It's invalid. So it's the joint eigenstate with eigenvalue 1 of all of such correlation operators. If you have this, you can do a universal quantum computation, given that you can do something else, namely that you can do projective von Neumann measurements on each of these qubits. So you have to be able to project the qubits into state 0 and 1 along a certain set of directions on the Bloch sphere. Okay. So we have to be able to measure certain spin variables sigma along the direction n. And so the universal set we chose one of them is the direction z. And there's a continuous set of directions on the equator of the Bloch sphere, like this. So if you have this, it corresponds in the circuit model to the situation where you have a C0 gate and a continuous set of SU2 rotations. You can do with less. It also works if you just take a discrete set that would be the three directions x, y, and z on the Bloch sphere, but also a direction between x and y, 45 degrees. And in fact, you can try to minimize these directions. You can, if you modify this resource, you can remove some of these directions, can in fact do the computation with a smaller number than this, but I'm not going into details about that. The second thing is, well, you have to say, how do you operate this thing? So there has to be a notion of a program. The program is encoded in a measurement pattern on the lattice. So if we have a quantum algorithm, for example, described in the quantum circuit, we can map it onto a set of directions on the lattice. And I should say from the beginning that some of these directions are fixed just from the structure of the algorithm, but some of these directions, those which are not along this main axis of the Bloch sphere, they are only fixed up to a plus and minus sign with respect to reflection in the Bloch sphere. And the exact sign of this angle depends on measurements results of previous measurements in the lattice. So it's an adaptive scheme. You make a measurement, you make new measurements on subsequent qubits, taking into account the classical outcomes of previous measurements. That is how it works, and this is an algorithm that you see here in a way I'm going to explain. And then there has to be a set of rules for processing these classical measurement results and choosing the new adaptive measurement directions. That has been described, the first two papers here. There's one paper about what is a cluster state, what properties do this data, that's here. And then there's a paper about this computational scheme that are described here. So I have to, let me make no further remarks, but let me try now to explain, first of all, how do you create such a cluster state? There are several possibilities to do that. A physical possibility, of course, you have to provide that is, if you have a certain type of interaction available. So you can create such a stabilizer state, and in fact, just to say it right away, this cluster state I described is one stabilizer, one eigenstate of this set of operators, of course. These are Hermitian operators, so you have 2 to the n many, there's a basis of such cluster state, and if we have any of these, it will do as well, just to say from that. So if we can create any state like this, we can easily transform it by some local manipulation into a cluster state. So how can we create such a state? We do the following. We first put all the qubits, or all the spins in the lattice in a certain direction. Let me call it the x direction. So the initial state is a tensor product of the spins polarized along x. And in the computational basis state, this would be a superposition of 0 and 1, and sometimes I will also call it plus. And then all I need to be able to do is to switch on an easing type of interaction for a certain time, and then to switch it off again. So if I have available an interaction of this type, where there is easing coupling between next neighbors, a standard easing model, and I leave this Hamiltonian on for a certain time such that the integrated coupling strength is pi, then the state, as you can easily convince yourself, is described, satisfies these eigenvalue equations. So that's the way how to create the cluster state. The other way is you could just measure, in an abstract sense, these correlation operators. A device like this, you project any initial state into an eigenstate of these operators, and you have the resource to start with. This is also a way to understand, from my perspective, the other measurement-based computation models. Doing that, you can reduce everything to measurements if you include the preparation process of the resource also as a method of projective measurement. Okay, so if you have this, you have the cluster. So let me give you a few explicit examples. A cluster state, now a cluster is in my language also always a subset of, to start with, in the lattice of sites in the lattice. So let's say you have just 2 sites, and you have, so the cluster would consist of 2 qubits, and then the cluster state associated with this is a simple Bell state. So this just tells you if you apply an easing interaction for a certain time, it corresponds to essentially a phase gate applied there. And you can easily convince yourself you get out of such a small cluster, you get a Bell state. If you take 3 particles, you get a GHZ state. If you take 4 particles, you get something else. So and if you go to explicit representation like this, the number of terms blows up exponentially. So this is a 4-qubit cluster state, if you like. Now, if you have large lattices like we are dealing with, you can show that the minimum number of terms you need to represent this in explicit representation grows exponentially with the number of qubits at least you need 2^n/2 many such terms if n is the number of qubits in the lattice. So this is a very bad way of dealing with these things. So it's good to go back to the stabilized formalism to describe this. But these were just a few examples. Now, I cannot really repeat or describe all the details of this scheme. Let me just point out the essential steps. How do you do quantum computation with the cluster? An essential observation is that the unitary evolution that with which you can create the cluster, this easing interaction here, it has only sigma z operators in its generator. Okay? That is to say, if you apply, for example, a sigma z rotation to one of these qubits and then entangle, or you apply it afterwards, it doesn't matter, it commutes. Likewise, since sigma z and this entangling operation commute, you can also, if you now perform z measurements, measurements along the z direction at certain qubits, it has the same effect as if you would have put these qubits into z eigenstates before the entangling operation, and you can effectively remove these qubits from a description. So what we will often do is in the first round, we will structure this universal resource. The statement is if you have the lattice in the cluster state is a universal resource, given a certain algorithm, we will start structuring this. We will start making, first of all, certain Z measurements along qubits, which removes them in a certain sense from the description. So if we measure a subset M of qubits on this part of a lattice, then the remaining unmeasured qubits define a set N that is the cluster minus M, and you can show that in fact the projected state is again a state that satisfies a similar set of eigenvalue equations. It's again a cluster state that lives on a lower dimensional structure, and this now gains some similarity of some circuit structure. This is what we are heading for. There's a typo in there, I'm not going to talk about that. Now, the general way of dealing with these things is that we will compose patterns that correspond to a complete algorithm with certain sub-patterns on the lattice. And here you see sub-patterns, for example, of the C0 operation, of the swap operation, and of some other operation. And the way to describe it, the canonical structure will be, for example, for 2-qubit gates, we take out a block, and we will identify 2 lines as input lines and 2 lines as output lines. And so we have input qubits, output qubits, and the shaded region, this will be called the body of this simulated gate. And you were able to show that measuring the qubits along the directions indicated here will in effect imply, if you do that, and then later measure the input qubits just in X, you will swap them to the output qubits and at the same time apply this logical operation described here. Now, if you've listened carefully, you were able to say what this structure, well, maybe you're not. This structure is just because Z measurements effectively remove this, these qubits from the lattice. You have just single lines, and these are 2 wires. These are 2 identical channels on the qubits. A wire that takes qubit 1 from here to here, and from here to here. Okay, these are a few examples. I cannot explain the entire details. Let me just choose one example. Let's take this swap. Why is this the swap gate here? So what we do is this. Again, we have this shall now be a certain cluster of qubits brought into this entangled state. How can I learn something from the correlations of the cluster about the gate? And I can do it by this. So this is all pictorial representation. It's an eigenstate of these operators. Apply sigma x here and sigma z to the neighbors, you get the state back. It's also an eigenstate of these operators. It's also an eigenstate of this operator. Since all of these operators commute, you can also multiply them. It's an eigenstate of this operator. You can play around with these things and also find out that it's an eigenstate, in fact, of this 4-qubit operator. Apply sigma x to these places here. What we will do now, having seen that, it means if we now measure, so these are correlations between these measured qubits. If we measure only a subset of these qubits, namely those which are in the body of the gate, we will get random outcomes here at these measurements, but we will leave these unmeasured. So we will transform these stabilized equations into new stabilized equations which have this form. So the state that is remained, this qubit and this qubit, is an eigenstate So yeah, so the entire cluster is an eigenstate of sigma z here, but also of sigma x here. If you play this game with all these patterns, you see that the remaining stabilizer, pictorial represented here, is given by this. And if you look at this hard enough, you will see that this corresponds just to a product of two Bell states, one going from input 1 to output 2, and one from input 2 to output 1. And if you then measure this input line, you make, in effect, a swap of the input qubits to the output qubits by changing the lines. So there, this is the kind of operations you use, and you can generalize this to a rather complicated pattern. This is what we did. The result is, as far as universality is concerned, you can give explicit patterns for the following set of gates. This, for example, makes a CNOT gate. Yeah, so measuring along these directions will translate information from here to here and apply at the same time a CNOT operation between these. There are smaller patterns like on this one-dimensional structure. If you measure such a one-dimensional structure, then you can realize any SU2 rotations. And the way we do it, we decompose a SU2, a Jahn-qubit rotation, by the Euler decomposition. And then you have three angles occurring. And in fact, the angles, the measurement angles that you see here, this is now in the equator of the Bloch sphere. These, the measurement directions you choose, correspond directly to the angle of these Euler rotations in this representation. So if you measure along these three angles, this structure, you will translate the qubit from here to here and at the same time rotate it via SU2 rotation. Now, please to note here, these, what you do when you measure this, you realize this operation only a modulo plus and minus sign. This is the genuine feature of this non-trivial SU2 rotations that you get this here. And in fact, this means what determines whether you choose plus or minus psi in a rotation is determined by the measurement outcome of of measurements on previous qubits. So in fact, this induces here, the Euler angle here corresponds to the measurement angle, i.e. the measured observable is this, and the plus minus sign means you have to choose this angle corresponding to the measurement outcome of previous qubits, and this introduces a temporal order in this computation scheme, and only this. And the Hadamard gate is a special case of this, which we'll meet later again. Now, I should also say something about the randomness of this scheme. Each measurement result, the outcome is random. Nevertheless, it's a deterministic scheme, and the situation why this is the case is similar as in a teleportation. So imagine you have you want to realize a teleportation from Alice to Bob. What is done in this protocol, you make a Bell measurement on Alice's side. Alice gets a random outcome, four different values, and she has to send this classical information to Bob, who will then apply one out of four Pauli operations to get the correct result. A similar situation we have here. By applying these measurement patterns here, we will swap the qubits from the input to the output and get the CNOT gate or the SU2 rotation modulo a certain set of Pauli operations, which is determined by the classical outcomes of these measurement results, and it can be applied. So in fact, what you can do in this scheme, you can imagine collect all these random byproduct operators, as we call them, and pool them, take account of them until the very end of the network, and before you make the readout measurement, the accumulated byproduct operators tell you the basis in which you have to measure the final readout. So it's like, and the way how you propagate these byproduct operators is like in a network. You imagine you have a quantum logic circuit, and at a certain place in the circuit, you have a random spin flip or phase flip operator. Then what you do, you just propagate these operators through the network and collect them to the time just before you make the final readout measurements. And these are then the accumulated byproduct operators. If you propagate such Pauli operators through certain gates, like the Clifford gates, the gates will remain the same. But if you propagate them through through these SU2 rotations, the non-trivial ones, you get a sign change, and this introduces again the temporal ordering of the scheme. But the basic message is you have individual random outcomes, but what counts is the multi-qubit correlations, and these are deterministic. Having said all this, what we have shown by this is that, in effect, this model can be used to simulate any quantum logic circuit. And the final pattern that you get is something that you, like this, that you really map a quantum given quantum logic circuit onto such a lattice structure, where this dimension of the lattice plays the role of the time of the quantum logic network, and this dimension of the lattice plays the role of the different logical qubits. So by measuring these qubits in the directions indicated here, you will propagate, so to say, the information at the same time, process it in a network fashion. Now, you don't need to decompose everything to this elementary gate C0 and these rotations, but you can find much more compact patterns to process. So there's just an example. This is a quantum Fourier transform, where here the different colors encode the different directions of the measurement. These are X measurements, these are Y measurements, and these blue ones are measurements in the XY plane. This is an example of a quantum adder that adds 8 quantum bits from here to here. And so it might look complicated, but in fact it's a quantum adder, so it adds the Morse superposition, something that you need also at Shor's algorithm. And it's then an interesting task how you would efficiently, if you have, so for an algorithm, you need to be represented as measurement patterns. How do you process these patterns, and can you invent a language for these processing? And this is one of the works that Elham and Monsaldanos are following, as I understand. But there's now an important remark to be made. So far, we have only shown that this device can be used to simulate quantum logic circuits. However, please note that if you look at these gates in more detail, you see that several of the gates, for example, the C0 gate or the Hadamard gate or this phase gate, pi over 2, those involve only measurements along X or Y. And these measurements, there is no adaptive scheme. They can all be performed simultaneously. And that means that in such a measurement pattern, in principle, we can measure all the qubits that are involved in gates that constitute the Clifford, that are Clifford gates. They can be done simultaneously, because these measurements are only involved, and the choice of these spaces does not depend on the result of previous measurements. There's no feed forward for this. This means that we find for all quantum circuits in the Clifford group, if we have circuits only composed of such gates, then we can measure the entire structure in one step and only have classical processing for this. So there's always, I should mention, a classical little device behind it that adds all these random outcomes. And it's a very primitive device. It doesn't need to be a Turing machine, because it basically just adds up binary numbers and adds them to a binary classical vector. But I'm going to talk about this later. So we find a unity logical depth for quantum circuits in the Clifford group, and that has some significance. And I come back to this. But it also means that we have to develop a different look at this model. So this was nice, and we could show by this how you can imagine you run a quantum algorithm. But as I have pointed out, for example, this structure here, I can just tell you this is a C0 gate. This is also one type of a C0 gate. Here are certain SU2 rotations involved in here. So it means at the input and at the output, and these C0 gates, all these qubits can be measured in a single step. And what remains are just a few qubits unmeasured. So the question is, if we choose a different measurement strategies, it's not clear what remains from this computational model. Quantum circuit simulation is not the appropriate model for processing algorithms on this machine, and we have to develop something better. And that's what we have been working on there. And so the new strategy we chose is this. We say, okay, the strategy will be that you measure every qubit at the earliest possible time. So for the previous structure, it means that the blue ones are the one you can measure in the first measurement round. They don't have to wait for any measurement outcomes. And the colored ones are qubits that you measure later. If you do this, it doesn't look like a circuit at all anymore. So what this will then be is the computational model has the following ingredients. You will take the cluster and you will decompose it into certain disjoint subsets of qubits of the cluster. And with the following rule that you can, that we have shown how you do this, the subsets of qubits are chosen such that all qubits of a given subset may be measured simultaneously, and the temporal order and there is a temporal order in which the different subsets are now measured. So the computation is then really described as a round of the several rounds of simultaneous one qubit measurements of on disjoint subsets of the cluster. So there, this is then the picture that emerges, and this has been worked out in this lengthy paper in Quantitative Comp. Please read this if you're interested in these details. And so the picture that emerges is that you have this cluster here. It is decomposed into disjoint subsets, and there's a measurement device that measures these different subsets simultaneously. It uses the classical outcomes to choose new to measure the next subset, etc., etc. So that's the model that emerges there. But let's now go back to this observation that all qubits, all measurement directions involved in Clifford gates are here along this main axis. That means if you have a quantum circuit given like this, so this is one example, then you can identify, why did I do that? Okay, for such a circuit you see that all the blue parts, these are gates that belong to the Clifford group, the Hadamard and C0, for example. While these unitary rotations are rotations around some angle around the axis Z or X. And if you have such a quantum circuit, what you do is you map it on the one-way model. That means it would correspond to a measurement pattern. And on the one-way model, you can remove all the blue part of this circuit in initial measurement round. So this has some resemblance to what you know, which is the Gottesman-Knill theorem that says if you have circuits composed entirely of Clifford gates, then these authors have shown that these circuits can be simulated efficiently on a classical computer. Now here the situation is not exactly like this. What you need here to apply this theorem is that the circuits really are composed entirely of Clifford gates. If you have certain non-Clifford gates, you don't know what to do. But we do know what to do if we run such an algorithm on the one-way model, because in this model we can, so to say, eliminate the Clifford part or the classically simulated part in the first round, and in this next round we deal with a substructure. So what I'm trying to say is this: so within the one-way model, it is possible to eliminate the Clifford part of a different quantum circuit, in the sense that you first take a quantum logic circuit, you map it on the cluster state, and you identify these different subsets of qubits that have to be measured in a certain measurement round. And after the first measurement round, that corresponds to removing the Clifford part or the classical part. It's not clear whether it is all what is classical, but this classical is simulatable. Then what you are left with are the still unmeasured qubits, and those define a graph state, which is the next part of my talk. And so this is the real structure you have to deal with. The quantum algorithm, essential quantum part here, the black part of the algorithm, will be mapped on a certain graph state and a set of rules how to measure the vertices of such a graph. The logical depth of the quantum algorithm, this model, is defined by the number of measurement rounds that you need to operate on this graph. I need to say that in principle you can go back to the circuit picture and say, well, this can be described as a circuit too. Okay, in that sense, equivalent. You can go back and say, okay, if you want to do the computation like this, you first start by creating this graph, and I'll describe it in a minute how you do it. It corresponds again to something like applying phase gates between these qubits. You can do it with a simple quantum circuit with constant depths for these phase gates, can be parallelized to a high degree, and then you just measure the output qubits in the way you have found out in the one-way quantum computer. So you can also describe it as a circuit model. Can be used for certain purposes, and I do think that Richard Joser is going to talk about this, if I'm right. If not, I'm just telling you. But you have to see that here, of course, the entire what goes on in the quantum quantum algorithm is all contained in the feed-forward scheme. I have not drawn this here. You make measurements on these output qubits, but there's a temporal ordering. You use some of the output results to measure new qubits, and you measure the next qubit. So there's classical processing here involved, and this you should not forget. So in some sense, it doesn't make sense to go back to the circuit model because you don't see the algorithm anymore. It's all in the classical processing here. So what I would like to do is understand better this stuff. So how is the graph state process? So to understand this, I would like to tell you a little bit what we know. We have investigated these graph states and derived some facts about this. Complexity, this. Okay, so what is a graph state? A graph state is defined like this. So take a classical graph, set of vertices and a set of edges. The vertices take the role of qubits, and the set of edges encode a stabilizer. So BG, a simple graph with n vertices. Then the graph state associated with this graph G is the common eigenstate with eigenvalue 1 of these correlation operators. It's a very simple generalization of the cluster state. The cluster state is a graph state where the graph is just the lattice I've described. So we classified these different graph states, calculated the Schmidt measure and entanglement measure for different classes of graphs in this paper. If you want to know more about this, you should read this, and I'll just tell you some of the facts we know. It's clear that, right, these correlation operators form a complete set of commutative observables, which is also the stabilizer proof of the state. And it's known that for every stabilizer state is local unitary equivalent to a graph state. So you can represent a stabilizer state by such a graph, modulo some local unitary operations on some of the vertices. And this can be very useful. So the entire spirit of what we have been doing the last few years is because in this computational model, you make measurements, you process entangled states. And you want to have an intuitive and a mathematically useful descriptions of how you map one state to the next state. And it turns out that such a graph theory, using graph theory to represent these states is useful there. So let me give a few examples of graph states that you know. This is a Bell state. Now please to note what you see here, these are not pictures like, you know, one qubit here, one qubit here, and some, you know, some EPR paper, but this is just a shorthand notation of a mathematical expression. It's a stabilizer composed of two operators. It's a stabilizer composed of six operators. So these are mathematical shorthand notations of stabilizer and i.e. the states. But you can also use them, and the experimentalists maybe like to do that, get also intuitive picture how you can create such entangled states by understanding these as qubits and these as phase gates or easing interactions between the qubits. So this is a Bell state. This is the graph corresponding to GFZ state. This is the graph that you can use to encode a single unknown qubit red into a 7-qubit CSS code by doing a teleportation process. This is the resource for teleportation into the CSS code. This one is the resource for doing universal quantum computation, namely the cluster state. So we have found that a large number of interesting states in quantum information theory can be represented like this in a graph, such a graph picture, and that's kind of useful. Now, you need to know a few facts about the graph states. So there is these LU equivalence. You can transform graph states to other graph states under certain local unitary transformations. And there is a useful rule, the local Clifford rule, that says two graphs that you can translate one graph to another graph by applying the square root of these correlation operators. If you apply square root of sigma x here and square root of sigma z to the neighbors, you get a new graph state, and the new graph associated with this state is obtained by local complementation. So if you choose a qubit, you choose the neighborhood of this qubit, and you complement the subgraph of the induced subgraph on the neighborhood of this qubit, which is this graph. So the GHZ state is both represented by such a graph and by such a graph, and if you choose a different basis, that is this rule. And there's, in fact, a rule that says that you can generate, if you start from a given graph state and you apply you apply local complementation, then you can generate the entire orbit of such a graph state under these, under local Clifford operation. It's a theorem that was derived by Van den Nest and others. The local complementation applied successfully to a given graph state generates the complete orbit of a graph state under the local Clifford group. So you can ask yourself, how big is the class of these graph states if the number of qubits grows? And that's an interesting question. We know some of the answers. We know it completely up to 7 qubits. We have the complete classification. But for more than that, there are some open questions. So for example, so for me, all of these graphs are represented by such a structure. This is just a linear cluster, all of them, because you can transform them into each other by local Clifford operations. For example, what you see here are then all the graph states up to 6 qubits that represent the entire class. I.e., they are not equivalent under local unitaries, not even under local SU, and they are not even equivalent under exchanging vertices, i.e. graph isomorphisms. And maybe I should take a short. This is just to demonstrate that we have explored this and we know some means to classify these graph states with this rule. Another thing you need to do is to see how do graphs transform if you apply measurements on them, because we need this in the measurement-based computer model. And you can derive these rules. This can also be found in this paper, but also in a paper by Schlingemann. And it says if you have a graph state and you apply a measurement along z, x, or y with certain outcomes, you will transform this graph into a product of the measured qubits and the remaining state that's again a graph state, modulo some local unitary operations. And these rules here have a compact form. I'll give you two examples. If you start with the graph state like this, this rule tells you, well, if you make a sigma x measurement on one qubit, you translate it into such a graph. If you make another sigma x measurement on this qubit, you translate it into such a graph. And you may ask, why do you do that? Why do you want to know that? Well, some of these graphs are interesting for us. For example, this graph is the graph of the quantum Fourier transform that you have in the one-way quantum computer. And the step of processing this involves operations of measurement of sigma x and sigma y on this graph. And if you do that and use these rules, you see that the new essential resource of the quantum Fourier transform here is described by this graph. And you can again describe this graph by using these rules. And you can even quantify the entanglement contained in these graphs by the Schmidt measure. So all of this is to convince you that to calculate the graph associated with the quantum part of an algorithm can be computed efficiently from the measurement pattern associated with the algorithm in the one-way model and with the transformation rules we have given. So the picture that emerges that in this one-way computer model, what we really are doing, we are processing graph states. So let me just name a few more properties of graph states. First, we have been able to show that all graph states, all connected graph states, violate local realism. That relates somewhat to the talk given by Clark Caves. So you can say that that you can construct Bell inequalities, all which are violated maximally by at least one of these graph states. So every graph state violates local realism, and you cannot develop an ordinary local hidden variable model for that. We've also been able to show that for every graph, more practical issue, so this now has some effect on the interpretation of this model. We have, from a practical side, we've been able to show that every graph state corresponding to a two-colorable graph, you can find an n-party distillation protocol. And this has some bearing on things we investigate in the context of fault-tolerant quantum computation. Can we use entanglement purification, which we know is very robust, as an integral part in the one-way quantum computer? That's ongoing research that Robert Rosendorf at Caltech and other people are following along these lines. And graph states with two-colorable graphs are, in fact, LU equivalent to CSS states that can be shown as well. So the summary of the model is this. I think there are two features that should be emphasized. I think number one, we have a clear conceptual separation of the classical and the quantum part of this device. In the following sense, we do have everything that's quantum about the quantum computer here is contained in this resource of entangled qubits. It's prepared once, and then there's no further interaction. If you look for quantum things, it's in here. The entire processing of this is classical. You process classical information only. So the measurements that you do are a kind of read and write processes. You make a measurement, you get a classical result, that's what you read, but also you write by choosing a certain measurement direction, you structure the resource. Change it somehow by choosing a measurement direction, you get out a classical result. This determines, and you collect this result in a 2n bit vector, where n is the number of logical qubits you want to process, and you update this vector, choose new measurement directions. It's a little bit like in a Turing machine, but this is all classical, except maybe the measurement device serves a dual purpose. It brings you from the quantum world to the classical world. It interacts with the quantum resource, but you get classical results. You use the results to make new interactions, get again classical results. That's the kind of model you have. And that might have some interest for interpretation issues. The universal cluster state that you operate on, it represents all quantum correlations that may be exploited for logical processing. That's what you can say for sure. What you want to do with that is a different story. From a practical side, I do think that the model should provide a new platform also for formulating and analyzing algorithms in the way I've described. You can go from the circuit model, map it on the one-way model, investigate things in the model, in the one-way model, but also go back to the network model if you like. So, and I think there are also the subsequent talks by Richard and by Elham that will explore on this. I think my time, I don't know, is it basically over? Or do I have 2 or 3 more minutes? Where is the chair? Is it okay? I don't know when I started. Yeah, okay. Yeah, what makes a quantum computation? what have I learned from this? I told you I don't know. But it makes clear that the question that is often posed, what is it, what are the essential ingredients in a quantum computation? Is it the superposition, i.e. giving rise to interference of different computational paths? Is the unitary evolution essential? Is it entanglement that we really do need? What role does measurement play? Somehow all of these things come in, yeah, and probably you cannot single out a single one. But I would like to know, can you somehow find essential primitives of this? And I don't know. But I remember, and this maybe with this I conclude also this talk in this meeting, there was a meeting organized by Chris Fuchs in Montreal 3 years ago, where we went in a little bit a different direction, more interpretational issues. And the task of the speakers at the end was to assign some homework problems or something like this for the audience. And in a similar talk, I thought about this, and maybe I can come up with this again. I used the old slides there, so I didn't really adopt it to this audience, but I think it's appropriate. So, of course, it seems that, you know, how can you interpret this model? It has some resemblance with the Turing machine, with the Turing machine, because you can read this cluster state as a quantum kind of tape. The measurement apparatus would correspond to classical read and write head, but you have a distinguished role between reading and writing. It is a very different role in a quantum mechanical context. So with this, you change the resource, and here you read the binary outcome. And the finite state machine is something that really updates this information flow vector that carries you from one round to the next one. This was some question I posed then. I learned then later that Simon Perdrix et al. Have worked on this in a different direction than I imagined, but I would like to advertise also his poster in this on this works on quantum measurement-based quantum Turing machines in this context. Then, if you ask what is a quantum computation, is it quantum correlations? That's, I think, the thing I favor. But I have to be more careful in phrasing this in words, and time would kind of run out. It's clear that we don't need the correlata for the quantum processing, because these states are like GHZ states, and Mermin has shown that in his interpretation of quantum mechanics, that it makes maybe some sense to talk about quantum correlations without talking about what is behind these correlations. This may be a more philosophical aspect, but it's clear that the concept of quantum correlation is certainly, it's fair to say that it plays an essential part in this model. And I do think that it also is a fundamental concept that relates both to physics and to logic. Correlation is a physical concept because it refers to outcomes of measurements on a physical object. That's what we talk about in physics. But it's also, in some sense, a logic. It has some roots in logic because with correlation, you can at least define the identity or the negation. And what else you can define, maybe you'll see in this model. So quantum correlations are useful there. And that last slide, maybe, is most appropriate to this audience is, of course, as other people have observed, you see here in particular that quantum computation can be, you forget about correlations altogether, you say, from the most abstract level, what you do is you start with a cluster state in a certain, it's a certain entangled state in a high-dimensional Hilbert space. And the only thing you do is you make a series of projective measurements on this resource. You structure the resource, and you get out, in each round, you get out binary outcomes. So the conceptual framework is really, if you interpret the measurement results as series of yes-no propositions about the state of this resource, you have the conceptual framework of Birkhoff and von Neumann and followers. Please know this was 3 years ago, and I didn't have the pleasure to learn all the things I learned in this audience. But I think it goes a little bit in this direction. And maybe using the combining the insights the quantum logic community provides and all the algebraic structures, maybe one can get further here. My homework assignment then to the audience was formulate the quantum computation entirely as a mapping on a non-Boolean lattice of propositions, thereby establishing the logic of quantum computation. I have a real hope that something like this may be achievable and that we may learn something about the question, what is quantum computation? So thank you for your attention. Why exponentially? No. Why should exponentially? It cannot scale. Why do you say exponentially? I mean, suppose you've given a quantum circuit. So one, you have the circuit has a certain size. Yeah, the number of gates in it, and the number of rounds is certainly less than the number of than the circuit size. In fact, the depth, the logical depth of this is certainly smaller or equal than the logical depth of the circuit you start with the network model.